Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is Side 2 of For the Record Program Number 350, titled, The One Who Killed Kennedy Was Trained for 3 Years. This is being recorded on March 3rd of 2002. The title of the program is a direct quote from Sheikh Omar Rahman, who was convicted in connection with the first set of attacks on the World Trade Center and related conspiracies. He was taped discussing with one of his associates, who in turn was part of the milieu trained by Ali Mohammed, an infiltrator into U.S. intelligence on behalf of al-Qaeda. This particular individual was discussing with Sheikh Rahman whether it would violate Islamic law to blow up FBI headquarters in Manhattan. Sheikh Rahman was then quoted as saying, "Slow down, slow it down a little bit. The one who killed Kennedy was trained for 3 years." And then the Wall Street Journal of 11/26/2001 goes on to add that it was not clear what assassination he was talking about. What we're going to be doing as the first item up, so to speak, in this side is excerpting a section of RFA program number 8 that is about the assassination of Martin Luther King. As we've looked at in numerous broadcasts, including the Guns of November Part 4 and RFA number 8, among others, there are numerous evidentiary tributaries connecting the assassinations of both John Kennedy in November of 1963 with that of his brother Robert in June of 1968, and in turn connecting those assassinations to the assassination of Martin Luther King 2 months before Robert Kennedy was killed, and in turn those assassinations have strong evidentiary tributaries running to the shooting of George Wallace in May of 1972. Now, it is my belief, and this is conjectural, that Sheikh Rahman was alluding to the assassination of Robert Kennedy. The patsy in the Robert Kennedy assassination was a Palestinian Arab named Saran Saran. As we looked at in RFA program number 9, dealing with the assassination of Robert Kennedy, the evidence suggesting that Saran was not the assassin but was the carefully manipulated patsy is very, very strong indeed. Saran, however, was a Palestinian Arab who ostensibly wanted to kill Robert Kennedy because of his support for Israel. The evidence suggests very strongly that, in fact, it was the same type of elements, in fact, the same elements who killed Robert Kennedy, the elements who killed Robert Kennedy were the same as those who had killed his brother and Martin Luther King. We concluded Side 1 by examining a section of the book Government by Gunplay, co-authored or co-edited by Sid Blumenthal and Harvey Azizian. In turn, we looked at an essay about the assassination of Martin Luther King by Jeff Cohen, now associated with Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting. In turn, that essay dealt with, among other things, an affidavit submitted by Robert Byron Watson, who was working at the Magellan Art Gallery in Atlanta, Georgia. As we're going to look at in this excerpt of RFA program number 8, Robert Byron Watson had come across apparent elements of the assassination plot against Martin Luther King and against Robert Kennedy. Robert Kennedy was killed 2 months after Martin Luther King. And these assassinations, in turn, as we've looked at in other broadcasts, link up with the assassination of John Kennedy. Among the elements that you're going to hear described here are former U.S. Representative Larry McDonald of Georgia. Larry McDonald was in turn associated with Western Goals, an ultra-right-wing private intelligence organization that, among other things, was utilizing elements of the Los Angeles Police Department's Public Disorder and Intelligence Division to spy on people in Los Angeles. That case was the focal point of a civil suit, and before Larry McDonald could give evidence in that case, he was killed Korean Airlines Flight 007 was brought down. That was a major incident in the Cold War, and the evidence would suggest that it was not, in fact, the Soviets who brought that down, but that was the official version in what appears to have been either a provocation and or some other type of manipulated incident. We haven't got time to go into that now, but note the following excerpt from RFA 8, this is about the assassination of Robert Kennedy. Do note that Larry McDonald was connected with this milieu. Note, in particular, the name of Fuad Habash. Fuad Habash's name was apparently part of Fuad Habash, I should say, the brother of George Habash, about whom we're going to say more in a few minutes. Fuad Habash was connected to the group that appears, from the information we're about to hear, to have been connected to killing not only Martin Luther King, but also Robert Kennedy. Bear in mind that the patsy for the assassination of Robert Kennedy, Saran Saran, was a Palestinian Arab. It is my belief that Rahman was alluding to Saran Saran in the belief that it was actually Saran who committed the assassination. But note the name of Fuad Habash and the name of Anthony Malak, and note the connection of Fuad Habash to his brother George. This is from RFA number 8, recorded on April 4th, 1985, in addition to my own voice. You will also hear the voice of my very charming and capable former co-host, Nip Tuck, who assisted me with the on-air responsibilities. Now, this article is entitled, this again, from the Hudson Valley Chronicle, July of 1977, Volume 1, Number 1. The article is entitled, King Assassination Conspiracy Revealed. This is by a man named David Wemple, W-E-M-P-L-E. And Wemple writes, through nearly a decade of threats, blackmail, beatings, and murder attempts, Robert Byron Watson has steadfastly maintained that both the United States federal government and the forces of organized crime have persecuted, framed, and imprisoned him for one reason and one reason only, that he possesses knowledge implicating agents of these groups in a conspiracy to murder Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. and others. For those willing to hear his story, it should become readily apparent why the endless mysteries of America's political assassinations remain unsolved. When the intimacy existing between government, organized crime, and the intelligence community is laid out before one's eyes, it must seriously be questioned whether or not our present form of government can weather the intense scrutiny to which such knowledge must lead us. Watson was but a young man when on March 28, 1968, he claims to have overheard a portion of the conspiracy to murder Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr. As an acknowledged authority on art history and archaeology, even by those whom he most closely identifies with the conspiracy, he became employed at Magellan's Art Gallery in Atlanta, Georgia, and worked at the pricing of various artifacts. Magellan, by the way, is M-A-G-E-L-L-O-N. The gallery's business associates were fighting amongst themselves, however, by Christmas of 1967. It wasn't until a year or so later that Watson learned of the reason for this split. Bill Arnett, A-R-N-E-T-T, one of the original gallery partners, had apparently begun to suspect several others of using the gallery to front for illegal operations involving what Byron Watson consistently refers to in statements as, quote, the syndicate, unquote. The type of individual who often found his way to the halls of Magellan's, according to Watson, was characterized by a rather frequent visitor named Larry McDonald. A United States representative from Georgia, McDonald reigns from Marietta, from which the awesome and scandal-ridden Lockheed Corporation bases its East Coast operations. Aside from his membership on the John Birch Society's National Council, McDonald has been accused by the U.S. Labor Party and others of acting as a conduit for intelligence operations and various ultra-right-wing groups. In the meantime, he has gained a notoriety of sorts by saturating the congressional record with tirades like Maoist subversives in U.S. factories and Martin Luther King Jr.'s relationship with the communists. Within such an atmosphere of reactionary politics and corruption, says Watson, syndicate operations flourished, which included gold bullion smuggling from South America, as well as the importation upon a truly vast scale of cocaine and heroin.
Okay, skipping along in the article. The operations into which Byron Watson gradually became involved through this blackmail brought him an ever-increasing knowledge of organized crime and its relationship to the U.S. federal government. Although deeply involved in narcotics-related activities, he steadfastly maintains that he never took an active role in the actual trafficking, and that any, quote, evidence of this has been fabricated in a successful attempt to have him framed and imprisoned for the knowledge which he possesses. His awareness of drug smuggling activities, however, is substantial. While visiting Southeast Asia and purchasing huge amounts of artifacts for sale at Magellan's, for instance, he noticed that his traveling companion, Bill Jackson, was buying large quantities of teak logs. They were hollowed out at points, filled with narcotics, and shipped back to the U.S. I should just mention that Bill Jackson, mentioned here in the article, is one of the people I believe that was mentioned as, along with Gene Purcell and Bill Jackson's brother, Herman Jackson, as being the people that were having a discussion with Jerry Adams about these people all, of course, being Byron Watson's employers, about the assassination of Martin Luther King. We're going to get back to Herman Jackson a little later on, but remember that Herman Jackson is one of the people involved in this, and this is his brother Bill Jackson that Watson is claiming was involved with buying these teak logs. Okay. These teak logs were hollowed out at points, filled with narcotics, and shipped back to the U.S. A good deal of this information was forwarded by Watson to Atlanta Public Safety Commissioner A. Reginald Eaves. Eaves, whose, quote, conscience forced him to launch an investigation of Watson's charges in the summer of 1975, conceded that his drug-related data, at least, had proven to be, quote, about 95% accurate, unquote. The leads which Watson has provided in regards to the intimacy between government and syndicate, as well as about political assassinations, therefore may well be something to be reckoned with.
As fate would have it, Watson's hurried journey to Chile would provide a vital piece to the puzzle of the King assassination. It was while in Santiago that Byron found it literally impossible to receive any funds which had been sent to him from home. When there was some more money to be had, he was befriended by the South American director of the National Front for the Liberation of Palestine, Fuad Habash Ansara, whose brother George Habash is the leader of the National Front. Habash and Watson, as it turned out, had a mutual acquaintance who often visited Magellan's in Atlanta. That man, Dr. Anthony N. Malik, was the party named by Watson as buying the gold bullion which was being smuggled into the United States by Herman Jackson. Recall that Herman Jackson is the alias which apparently Jack Youngblood used, or someone who used a number of different names, including Jack Youngblood. Habash and others apparently suspected Malik of being a double agent with the CIA, a possibility which surfaced when Malik traveled to Chile immediately prior to the CIA-inspired coup d'etat against Allende in 1973. If Habash's suspicions were correct, Malik was one of those CIA agents who had attempted to infiltrate such national liberation organizations as the Palestinian Liberation Organization, the PLO, and the National Front for the Liberation of Palestine. The Central Intelligence Agency has, in fact, carried out infiltrative and provocative acts against such American groups as the American Indian Movement, Black Panthers, and Students for a Democratic Society. Later in 1974, Watson claims that Herman Jackson told him that Malik was also, quote, the man who conceived most of the plan and worked out most of the details which were employed to assassinate Senator Robert Kennedy. Now, again, note the name of Fuad Habash, who was part of that milieu, apparently involved, at least according to Robert Byron Watson, whose allegations were to a considerable extent, as we looked at in Side 1, supported by subsequent investigations. Of the name of Fuad Habash, the brother of George Habash, should be noted in that regard. Note also that one of the associates of Fuad Habash was Anthony Malik, according to Robert Byron Watson, one of the key players in the assassination of Robert F. Kennedy. And again, the patsy in that assassination, Saran was a Palestinian Arab who supposedly killed Robert Kennedy because of his antipathy to Kennedy's support for Israel. Now, what we're going to look at next is the political heritage of George Habash, the brother of Fuad Habash. We're going to be turning once again to the landmark text, Dreamer of the Day, subtitled Francis Parker Yockey and the Postwar Fascist International. That was authored by Kevin Coogan, published in softcover by Otano Media, Incorporated, and it was copyright 1999. The ISBN number 1-57027-039-2. The book, by the way, was edited by Dave Mandel, an on-air personality at sister station WFMU-FM in Jersey City, New Jersey. We're going to be taking a look now at François Genoux. We've spoken about Genoux in, among other programs, For the Record 333. We came back to Genoux in For the Record program number 341. We've also looked at Genoux in For the Record program number 344. And we're going to take a look at Genoux, his connections to Carlos the Jackal, his connections in turn to attorney Jacques Vergès, the attorney not only for Carlos at one point, but also someone associated with Habash, and the attorney for Klaus Barbie. And I'm going to review some more of the interesting links here in a few minutes. of by the way, the use of Kevin Coogan's text here should not be misunderstood as constituting endorsement by Kevin Coogan for the working hypothesis I presented on September 11th. Of François Genoux and his connections to George Habash, the brother of Fouad Habash, we read, on May 30, 1996, an obscure Swiss banker named François Genoux committed suicide in Geneva, Switzerland. From the brief mention of his death in the New York Times, one would not know that one of the most important figures in the history of 20th century terrorism had died. And how many men can say that they were friends with both Adolf Hitler and Carlos the Jackal, skipping down? Genoux was in the thick of things, having established a friendship with SS General Karl Wolff, leader of the German team in Italy that negotiated Operation Sunrise with Dulles. Shortly after the war, Genoux acquired the publishing rights to the works of Adolf Hitler, Martin Bormann, and Joseph Goebbels. He also played a major, if murky, role in aiding fugitive Nazi war criminals. Skipping down still further, speaking of the relationship between Genoux and Jacques Vergès, after the war in Algeria, Genoux met an ultra-left French lawyer named Jacques Vergès, who represented a number of FLN militants accused of terrorist bombings in Algiers' French section. By the way, the FLN was the Algerian organization that was struggling against the French governance of Algeria, a former French colony. Skipping down. After the 1967 war, Genoux and Vergès would reunite to support the Arab struggle against Israel. On February 18, 1969, members of the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, or PFLP, attacked an El Al plane on the tarmac of Zurich's Kloten Airport. When the trial of three of the PFLP militants began in November of 1969 in Winterthur, Switzerland, both Genoux and Vergès were in the courtroom serving as advisors to the defendants. Genoux's closest radical Arab friend was PFLP co-founder Dr. Wadi Haddad. A Greek Orthodox Christian, Haddad fled to Palestine in 1948. He then studied medicine with his fellow Greek Orthodox colleague George Habash at the American University in Beirut. In the early 1950s, Haddad and Habash founded the Arab Nationalist Movement, or ANM, which published a small journal called Vengeance. Skipping down. The ANM's embrace of socialism eventually led to an internal factional struggle in which Haddad and Habash represented the right, while Nayef Hawatama stood for the more ideologically orthodox left. After the 1967 war, the ANM was reorganized and became the PFLP. Now, the group praised Mao, Lin Piao, Che Guevara, and the Tricontinental Congress. Habash and Haddad declared themselves leftists and embraced the Vietnamese Revolution because of U.S. support for Israel. And again, bear in mind that George Habash is the brother of Fouad Habash. Skipping down still further, bear in mind that, as we looked at in For the Record 341 and 343, François Genoux was very active on behalf of Carlos the Jackal after Carlos the Jackal was arrested in Sudan in 1994. Returning to Coogan's text, Genoux became directly involved in helping Carlos after the Jackal was arrested in the Sudan by French agents on August 15, 1994. For some years after Wadi Haddad's death, Carlos operated out of bases in Hungary and other Eastern European countries. He also spent time in Damascus. After his arrest, Genoux publicly expressed his great admiration of Carlos, whom Genoux considered one of the heroes of the Palestinian cause. By the way, I would stress that, as we looked at in 341 and 344, Carlos the Jackal was represented after his arrest by Isabel Coutant-Père, who in turn is marrying Carlos the Jackal. She is also a protege of Genoux protege Jacques Vergès, and she is representing Zacharias Moussaoui, the 20th hijacker. I'm going to take a look at a speculative element, and this is presented as pure rumination. We're going to turn to the book Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, authored by Paul Manning. What we're going to look at is a portion of the FBI file on Martin Bormann, which was accessed by Paul Manning in his book. And as we're going to see, Martin Bormann made withdrawals on personal demand accounts on August 4th, August 5th, and August 14th in 1967. As we looked at in For the Record 283, among others, the Bormann Organization and the Deadly Mueller Organization, headed up by former Gestapo chief Heinrich Mueller, did work with elements of U.S. intelligence during the Cold War. One of the things I wonder about is the possibility about whether the assassinations of Martin Luther King, Robert Kennedy, and perhaps also John Kennedy may have been effected in part by the Bormann Mueller Organization, perhaps working on contract. Turning to Paul Manning's book, when the FBI file, now in my possession, was received at FBI headquarters, it revealed that the Reichsleiter, parenthetically Martin Bormann, had indeed been tracked for years. One report covered his whereabouts from 1948 to 1961 in Argentina, Paraguay, Brazil, and Chile. The file revealed that Bormann had been banking under his own name from his office in Germany in Deutsche Bank of Buenos Aires since 1941, that he held one joint account with the Argentinian dictator Juan Perón, and on August 4th, 5th, and 14th, 1967, had written checks on demand accounts in First National City Bank, Overseas Division of New York, the Chase Manhattan Bank, and Manufacturers Hanover Trust Company, all cleared through Deutsche Bank of Buenos Aires. Again, I wonder if those three withdrawals made in August of 67 might in any way be connected to the assassinations of Martin Luther King in April of 68 and Robert Kennedy in June of that same year. Now, one of the elements that overlaps the bridge running from the assassinations of Martin Luther King and Robert Kennedy all the way on up through Al-Qaeda, and this, oddly enough, one of the evidentiary tributaries on two legs, is Ramsey Clark. Ramsey Clark was Attorney General of the United States and also was a liaison between the Justice Department and the Warren Commission. He actively worked to obstruct Jim Garrison's investigation into the John Kennedy assassination, and then as Attorney General in April of 68 and again in June of 68, he announced that there was no conspiracy involved in the assassinations of either Martin Luther King or Robert Kennedy when, in fact, no adequate investigation had been begun. I would note that Ramsey Clark is going to be representing the son of Sheikh Rahman. Sheikh Rahman's son was apprehended by U.S. forces in Afghanistan. He is going to be represented by Ramsey Clark. What we're going to do now is to review a section from the Miscellaneous Archive Show, Observations on America's 216th Birthday. This was recorded on July 5th of 1992. We're going to read now, again from Coincidence or Conspiracy, about Ramsey Clark, again, one of the darlings of the progressive political community. Reading now from Fensterwald's book, Ramsey Clark, who later served as Attorney General under President Johnson, was one of the Justice Department officials who worked in a liaison capacity with the investigation being conducted in 1964 by the Warren Commission. In 1967, Attorney General Clark became the subject of criticism by various Warren Commission critics, including New Orleans District Attorney Jim Garrison. On March 2, 1967, the day after District Attorney Garrison announced the arrest of businessman Clay Shaw on charges of conspiring to assassinate President Kennedy, Attorney General Ramsey Clark stated that the FBI had already investigated Shaw, quote, in November and December of 1963, unquote, and had, again quoting, cleared, unquote, him of any involvement. The Associated Press account of Ramsey Clark's remarks stated, Clark said today the Federal Bureau of Investigation has already investigated and cleared Clay L. Shaw, a businessman arrested in New Orleans, of any part in the assassination of President John F. Kennedy. Clark said the Justice Department knows what Garrison's case involves and does not consider it valid. Clark said Shaw, quote, was included in an investigation in November and December of 1963, unquote. Again, quoting, on the evidence that the FBI has, there was no connection found between Shaw and the assassination of the president in Dallas on November 22, 1963, unquote, Clark said. Then Fensterwald goes on to say,
Ramsey Clark's statement proved to be completely inaccurate. No such investigation of Clay Shaw by the FBI or Justice Department ever took place. Within a matter of days, Attorney General Clark retracted his statement without explaining his apparent misinformation. In a March 12, 1967 Face the Nation interview on CBS, Clark declined to comment on his previous inaccurate remarks about Clay Shaw, stating, quote, "It would be inappropriate for me to comment on the case," unquote. Well, he apparently did not feel that way before. He sure commented on it and did so erroneously. Continuing now with Fensterwald's account. In the same interview, CBS correspondent George Herman, H-E-R-M-A-N, questioned the Attorney General about the FBI's secret classified files on David Ferry, the other key assassination suspect in Garrison's investigation. Herman asked, quote, "Now, Mr. Ferry has been dead several weeks, and the Ferry material is still classified, and I wonder if that is at the order of the FBI and Justice Department," unquote. Clark replied, quote, "No, those documents are under the general jurisdiction of the General Services Administration at this time," unquote. Fensterwald goes on to say, "This statement was also inaccurate, as the Ferry documents had specifically been classified under orders from FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover and his aides. The Ferry documents were also subsequently withheld from Jim Garrison by the Justice Department when Garrison subpoenaed them for his investigation." That last sentence again. "The Ferry documents were also subsequently withheld from Jim Garrison by the Justice Department when Garrison subpoenaed them for his investigation." And skipping down in Fensterwald's text here, we find, "On the last day that Clark served as Attorney General, he ordered the Justice Department to withhold from New Orleans District Attorney Jim Garrison the X-rays and photographs from the autopsy of President Kennedy. Garrison had subpoenaed these items in connection with his unsuccessful prosecution of Clay Shaw, and his subpoena had been upheld by a judge in Washington, D.C. Clark, however, appealed the judge's ruling, and the materials were never, in fact, produced." And bear in mind, again, the death of Lieutenant William Pitzer, a supposed suicide, but the gun was in the wrong hands. In the wrong hand, I should say, that also has worked to obscure evidence in the vis-a-vis the autopsy photographs of President Kennedy. I would also note, in addition to helping to frustrate Garrison's investigation, darling of the progressives, Ramsey Clark, also neglected to investigate the assassination of Martin Luther King or Robert Kennedy to any significant extent. Reading again from Penn Jones' Forgive My Grief, Volume 3 of Ramsey Clark and the Martin Luther King assassination, Penn Jones writes, from April 11th of 1968, "Since the assassination of President Kennedy, the Justice Department has been honed to a fine edge as a tool for punishing criminals. Under the Mickey Mouse Attorney General, as Jim Garrison calls him, Ramsey Clark of Dallas can determine before a suspect is caught that there was no conspiracy. On TV, Clark has solemnly proclaimed," and again this is April 11, 1968, beginning again, "on TV, Clark has solemnly proclaimed that there was absolutely no conspiracy involved in the killing of Dr. King. Of course, the suspect, who may not be guilty, hasn't even been apprehended, but we are sure there was no conspiracy." That's 1 week after Martin Luther King was assassinated. Clark performed the same way vis-a-vis the assassination of Robert F. Kennedy. And again, bear in mind that Ramsey Clark, in addition to his work as Attorney General, had been a Justice Department liaison with the Warren Commission and had been instrumental in helping to frustrate Jim Garrison's investigation.
That, again, excerpted from the Miscellaneous Archive Show, Observations on America's 216th Birthday, from July 5th of 1992. Ramsey Clark is going to be representing Sheikh Rahman's son, a member of Al-Qaeda. Among his other previous clients are Nazi war criminal Carl Linnaeus and Lyndon LaRouche, interestingly enough. My nickname, by the way, for Ramsey Clark is the American Jacques Vergès, Ramsey Youssef Clark. That concludes For the Record program number 350, Side 2. The one who killed Kennedy was trained for 3 years. This is being recorded on March 3rd of 2002. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.